Okay. Hello, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us during lunch. The title, first of all, my name is Holly Sinkowitz. I'm a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And Kelly is in the audience. She is a second author on this presentation, so we're glad that she was able to be here as well. But the title of this presentation is Still in Africa, The Process of Interviewing Recently Resettled Refugees in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's not quite the policy stance that's been going on so far, but it's more of a process presentation. Okay, we have no relationships to disclose. So just a brief outline. I'll give you just a brief background of refugees in North Carolina, a brief study overview, and then factors to consider when interviewing this population, and also address potential, give strategies to address potential challenges when interviewing this population. First of all, this is just a brief background. Roughly between 15 and 20% of the refugees coming to the US are from continental Africa. For the state of North Carolina, we receive on average 2,200 refugees per year. Guilford County alone gets about 800, and Greensboro, North Carolina receives about 400 refugees per year. These are not just African refugees, these are from all over the world. So for our study, we conducted a community-based research study with the Center for New North Carolinians. They are a group working with immigrant and refugee populations in Greensboro. And the questions we decided to ask were, what expectations did refugees have about life in the U.S. prior to the migration? And also, do these pre-migration expectations align with the current reality they now face? And if not, in which ways do they differ? So for methods, it was a qualitative research study, semi-structured interviews. Participants had the option of being either interviewed in their home or in a community development center within walking distance of their house. We interviewed 10 people, 3 declined to participate. These were all French-speaking refugees who had been in the U.S. less than 3 years and were at least 21 years of age. The interviews were translated in real time. Interviews were audio-recorded and transcribed verbatim. And then incentives, we did offer participants $15 gift cards to a local grocery store for participating. So as far as now, where we encountered some challenges, scheduling interviews, there were definitely some cultural differences, just with differences pertaining to time. I don't know, for anyone who's ever traveled to either Africa or Southeast Asia or anywhere, us in the U.S. and Western Europe have very concrete notions of time. So when we say, you know, you'll meet someone at 2 p.m., very rarely would a refugee who's newly arrived actually show up at 2 p.m. So there's differences in how we orient ourselves around time. There's also cultural differences in the value of the word no. In some cultures, it's extremely rude to ever say no. So they might kind of skirt around the issue or hesitate, and that's just one difference that we encountered. Timing as well. The work schedules of employed refugees, a lot of the participants we either interviewed or sought to interview, several were unemployed, but the ones who were employed often work third shifts at convenience stores, anything like that, fast food restaurants. So if we were showing up at noon to interview someone, we think that's, you know, a good time, but really we were waking them up when we were knocking on their doors. So just to consider the work schedules of employed refugees. There was also some financial or difficulties contacting participants when scheduling interviews. A lot of refugees have pay-by-the-minute plans. So if their phone minutes are up, you might not be able to contact them for some time. And also, myself individually, I had a non-local telephone number. So with participants with pay-by-the-minute plans, it costs them more to call me than it would to call a local number. So luckily we were collaborating with a community partner, and luckily we had plenty of local numbers available that they could call if they did have a question. Oops. Okay, so to address these scheduling issues, we avoided scheduling interviews at specific times if at all possible. We just showed up. There are certain apartment complexes, certain areas where you can find refugees in Greensboro, North Carolina. So we just, as a research team, set certain days of the week and just decided to show up and see who we could find that day. And that worked pretty well for the most part. We varied the times and the days that we were present to try to catch the highest number of people. We also set a predetermined number of times that we would ask someone for an interview. So if we asked once and they said they were busy, we set the number at 3. So we'd ask them a total of 3 times. And if they were either busy or hesitant, then we took that as they really don't want to participate. We're not going to ask this individual again. And then as far as contacting participants, like I said, we wound up having local numbers for participants to call if they did have any questions about the consent form or about the study at all. So they could at least get a hold of us easier. And then for us as a research team, having multiple contacts for refugees is extremely important. So whether if you have an address, that's great and can actually physically knock on their door, or if you can get phone numbers of either spouses, neighbors, things like that is extremely helpful. Trust concerns. So working with refugees, a lot of them we noticed politically favorable responses. This could be due to unresolved effects of trauma, wherever they're coming from, and also a lot of them not fully aware of their rights as refugees, so still really afraid to say anything about the U.S. government, even though that's in their right to do so. There was a lot of fear with that. There's also a fear of getting the answer wrong. We told them, you know, there's no right or wrong answer, but in a refugee status determination interview, there is a right or wrong answer, and if you don't prove your case as a refugee overseas, you're not going to be accepted for resettlement, at least in the U.S. And then also many were not comfortable with the recording device, possibly due to prior persecution. So to gain the trust, we tried as hard as possible to reiterate that there are no right or wrong answers and stress confidentiality. As far as the recorder, a lot of times we just showed them how it works, and a lot of them had kids in the environment. So recording kids' voices was kind of a fun way to ease the tension of the recording device, and some we even emailed or uploaded files of their kids just singing or playing, and they just thought it was great. And sometimes when I go there now, there's still families asking if I have it and if I can get their kids singing a new song or something like that. So cultural aspects of research. There was some difficulties comprehending the overall purpose of the research. And also a lot were not familiar with traditional protocols and consent forms. And then another factor with this was we were working with the Center for New North Carolinians that works in these apartment complexes where refugees are housed. So having previously established relationships and connections with the team, when we were asking them questions, sometimes they would be like, oh, well, we talked about that last week, and it was really difficult to get them to elaborate on an answer while the recorder was going. And then also, there was times when there was multiple interviewees simultaneously, a lot of either sister pairs or mother-daughter pairs sometimes wanted to go together, so hearing one participant's voice pretty strongly versus another and trying to get the less talkative participant to engage a little bit more. We also had non-consenting individuals walking in and out of the interview environment continuously. We allowed participants to be interviewed whether it was in their home or a community development center. It was their choice. We wanted them to be comfortable. But with the comfort of a home environment comes some distractions as well. And then also word of mouth in the community. Once they heard that there was someone asking questions about certain topics, people or kids would run up to us and tell us what they thought, and they weren't consented and we didn't have the proper protocols, so there was a challenge with that. To address some of these, I would recommend being prepared to explain the purpose of your research in multiple ways. And also have members of the research team that are new. So we had some members of the research teams that the refugees had never met. So then during an interview, they could prompt and ask for clarification on aspects that some of the others might have already known. So that was a little bit more comfortable for participants. And also have a plan for handling non-consented individuals in the interview environment. Since people were walking in and out, we would be asking questions, and if a neighbor was walking through, they'd just say something and not only influence the participant that we're interviewing, but just we have that recorded now, but we can't really transcribe that because they were never consented. And just to have I would recommend having a plan in place for that. And also asking if it's okay to contact participants again. So in the event you need clarification, or in the event there is a pair that you're interviewing and one is much less talkative than the other, if you have permission to contact her again or him again, then maybe you can get some follow-up information. And also, depending on the population, consider requesting a waiver of documentation for informed consent on the IRB. So environmental challenges. We mentioned that it was in participants' homes or a community development center, so there was a lot of distractions. A lot of kids in the environment, a lot of TVs, computers on. So a lot of disruptions. Also stopping the interview to consent new participants. In one instance, a man came into the home and he was talking so much that, you know, we wanted to capture what he was saying, so we just stopped altogether, consented him, and then continued the interview with both of them. And then also some of this can contribute to transcription difficulties. So to address potential distractions in the interview before starting the environment, we made the greatest attempt possible to minimize noise, asked to turn off or lower TV, radio, computer volume, if at all possible. Microphones on your recorders work well as, we didn't have one, but I would recommend that as well. And then also assess the background noise versus the overall comfort of participants. We really wanted our participants to be comfortable, but at the same time, some apartments and home environments were so loud and distracting that we didn't necessarily capture all that we wanted to. And then finding a private interview location, if at all possible, within the apartment itself. So communication challenges, this was a really big one. We were interviewing French-speaking refugees. We had a French-speaking interpreter, but there were a mixture of languages going on. There were participants talking African dialects to each other, and more or less it seemed like conferring on an answer, but we have no idea of knowing this because we didn't have an interpreter for those specific languages, and then coming up with an answer in French. So that was quite challenging, and also with other people in the environment speaking different languages and then having no idea what they're saying and then it coming out in French was definitely challenging. And also some participants were not always familiar with interpretation norms, so would just, I don't want to say ramble, but would go on and on and on and be really excited about their story, but if you're translating in real time, that's really difficult to do, and our interpreter had to go back through some transcriptions at times and get that data back. So. And then also it's just some cultural issues, so gender incongruencies. We had male and female researchers on our team, but at some point we couldn't all show up at once, so sometimes it was only females going into a male-dominated house, and it was only an issue once, but it would have been better to have male and female present all the time, if possible. So translation and interpretation. So find a native speaker, if at all possible. Sometimes with smaller, less established refugee communities, this is really difficult to do, but I would highly recommend it if you can. And also discuss interpretation norms before beginning the interview. This is something we added on throughout the process, but you know, telling them to speak, if possible, a sentence or two, stop, wait for interpretation, and then continue. And then, again, including both male and female researchers. And letting participants say which one, you know, have a preference, which one they prefer interviewing them. So just to finish up, these are just general issues to consider when potentially beginning a research study with this population. Well, the interviews took place entirely in Greensboro, North Carolina. I think a lot of this data can be transferable to other locations with this population. The voices of refugees need to be adequately represented in research. Often they're not, so I think it's important to include them if possible, and also it can be done. It just requires a little bit planning and some forethought. I would just like to acknowledge our community partner, the Center for New North Carolinians. They were involved in every step of the research process, which was great, and then also our funders. So thank you. Are there any questions at the moment? Yes.
How did you decide to have the in-time interpreter as opposed to just translating that the interviews afterwards to kind of, I don't know, how did you weigh the balance of like interrupting the speaker, maybe making them feel less comfortable, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of that was financial constraints, just not necessarily having the funding to pay an interpreter to transcribe was a huge challenge for us. But yeah, I would recommend that in the future, and if funding allows it, to definitely have that take place instead. Yes?
I was just wondering, is that a translator, French translator?
Yes. our French interpreter had worked with this population before, so it wasn't entirely new to her. But she mentioned one of the challenges, though, is that her ear, she has to listen especially carefully. And she was saying she keeps having, if she had a few weeks off where we hadn't had an interview, she had to retrain her ear again for those particular accents and dialogues. And that was an issue as well, because while they're speaking French, it's not, I mean, the French would say it's not quite pure French. So in the interviews themselves, sometimes they would slip into African dialects and not quite really realize they were doing it. So that's when we had to interrupt and pull them back to the French, because we just had no idea what they were saying, if that was done. And also just being able to decipher all the different languages going on. That's why our interpreter said it was extremely challenging, which is why we would recommend a native speaker if at all possible. So, any other questions? Excellent, thank you.